own menu. Well, everything looks wonderful. It's going to be hard to decide. What do you think you'll have, Nora? I scanned the price column looking for the most exorbitant figure. Suddenly, Hank coughed and loosened his tie, as though he'd swallowed water down the wrong tube. His eyes went a little wide in disbelief. I followed his gaze and saw Marcy Miller stroll into the restaurant with her mom. Susanna Miller hung her cardigan on the antique coat rack just inside the front doors. Then both she and Marcy followed the hostess to a table four down from ours. Susanna Miller took a chair with her back to us, and I was pretty sure she hadn't noticed. Marcy, on the other hand, who was seated opposite her mom, did a double take in the middle of picking up her ice water. She paused with the glass inches from her mouth. Her eyes mimicked her dad's, growing wide with shock. They traveled from Hank to my mom, finally stopping at me. Marcy leaned across the table and whispered a few words to her mom. Susanna's posture stiffened. A tight feeling of impending disaster slid through my stomach and didn't stop until it settled in my toes. Marcy pushed out of her chair abruptly. Her mom grabbed for her arm, but Marcy was faster. She marched over. "So," she said, stopping at the edge of our table, "y'all having a nice little dinner out?" Hank cleared his throat. He glanced at my mom once, shutting his eyes briefly in silent apology. "Can I give an outsider's opinion?" Marcy continued in a bizarrely cheerful voice. "Marcy," Hank said, warning creeping into his tone. "Now that you're eligible, Dad, you're gonna want to be careful who you date." For all her bravado, I noticed that Marcy's arms had adopted a fine tremble. Maybe out of anger, but oddly, it looked more like fear to me. With his lips barely moving, Hank murmured, "I'm asking you politely to go back to your mother and enjoy your meal. We can talk about this later." Not about to be deterred, Marcy continued, "This is going to sound harsh, but it'll save you a lot of pain in the end. Some women are gold diggers. They only want you for your money." Her gaze locked solidly on my mom. I stared at Marcy, and even I could feel my eyes flashing with hostility. Her dad sold cars. Maybe in Coldwater that amounted to an impressive career choice, but she was acting like her family had a pedigree and so many trust funds they were tripping on them. If my mom was a gold digger, she could do much, much better than a sleazy car salesman named Hank. "And Coopersmiths, of all places?" Marcy went on, a note of disgust overshadowing her cheery tone. "Low blow. This is our restaurant. We've had birthdays here, work parties, anniversaries. Could you be any tackier?" Hank squeezed between his eyes. Mom said quietly, "I picked the restaurant, Marcy. I didn't realize it had special meaning to your family." "Don't talk to me," Marcy snapped. "This is between me and my dad. Don't act like you get any say in this." "Okay," I said, pushing up from my chair. "I'm going to the restroom." I sent my mom a quick look, hinting for her to join me. This wasn't our problem. If Marcy and her dad wanted to go at it and in public, fine. But I wasn't going to sit here and make a spectacle of myself. "I'll join you," Marcy said, catching me off guard. Before I could figure out my next move, Marcy looped her arm through mine and propelled me toward the front of the restaurant. "Mind telling me what this is all about?" I asked when we were out of earshot. I shifted my eyes between our linked arms. "A truce," Marcy stated pointedly. Things were getting more interesting by the minute. "Oh, and how long is it going to last?" I asked. "Just until my dad breaks up with your mom." "Good luck with that one," I said with a snort. She let go of my arm so we could pass single file into the ladies' room. When the door fell shut at our backs, she did a quick check under the stalls to make sure we were alone. "Don't pretend like you don't care," she said. "I saw you sitting with them. You looked like you were going to vomit out your eyes."
"Your point?"
"My point being, we have something in common." I laughed, but my laugh was of the dry, humorless variety. "Scared of taking sides with me?" she asked. "More like wary. I'm not particularly fond of getting stabbed in the back."
"I wouldn't stab you in the back," she flicked her wrist impatiently. "Not on something this serious."
Note to self, Marcy is only a backstabber on trivial things. Marcy boosted herself onto the sink's ledge. She was now half a head taller, looking down on me.
"Is it true you can't remember anything? Like, your amnesia is real?"
"Stay cool. Did you drag me in here to talk about our parents, or are you really that interested in me?" Lines of concentration formed on her forehead.
"If something happened between us, you wouldn't remember, right? It would be like it didn't happen, in your mind anyway."
She watched me closely, clearly intent on my answer.
I rolled my eyes. I was growing more irritated by the minute. Just spit it out. What happened between us? I'm being completely hypothetical here. I didn't believe that for a second. Marcy had probably humiliated me in some grand way before I'd vanished, but now that she needed my cooperation, she hoped I'd forgotten. Whatever she'd done, I was almost glad I couldn't remember. I had a lot more on my mind than worrying about Marcy's latest offensive strike. It's true, then, Marcy said, not exactly smiling, but not frowning either. You really can't remember. I opened my mouth, but I didn't have a comeback. Lying and getting caught in the act would say a lot more about my insecurities than just being upfront. My dad said you can't remember anything from the last 5 months. Why does the amnesia stretch back that far? Why not just from when you were kidnapped? My tolerance had reached its limit. If I was going to discuss this with anyone, Marcy wasn't first on the list. She wasn't on the list, period. I don't have time for this. I'm going back to the table. I'm just trying to get information. Ever consider it's none of your business? I said, my parting shot. Are you telling me you don't remember Patch? She blurted. Patch. As soon as his name fell from Marcy's lips, the same haunting shade of black eclipsed my vision. It vanished as quickly as it came, but left an impression. Hot, unaccountable emotion. Like an unexpected slap to the face. I momentarily lost the ability to draw breath. The sting radiated all the way to the bone. I knew the name. There was something about him. What did you say? I asked slowly, turning back. You heard me. Her eyes studied mine. Patch. I tried but failed to keep a blush of bewilderment and uncertainty from trickling into my expression. Well, well, Marcy said, not looking as pleased as I would have expected for catching me stripped and defenseless. I knew I should walk out, but that elusive flare of recognition caused me to hold my place. Maybe, if I kept talking to Marcy, it would return. Maybe this time it would hang around long enough for me to make something of it. Are you going to stand there and well-well me, or are you going to give me a hint? Patch gave you something earlier in the summer, she said without preamble. Something that belongs to me. Who's Patch? I managed at last. The question seemed redundant, but I wasn't about to let Marcy race on ahead until I was caught up, at least as much as I could be. 5 months was a lot of ground to cover in a quick trip to the bathroom. A guy I dated. A summer fling. Another potent stirring within that felt eerily close to jealousy, but I shoved the impression away. Marcy and I would never be interested in the same guy. Attributes she valued, such as shallow, unintelligent, and egotistical, didn't pique my interest. What did he give me? I knew I was missing a lot, but it was a really far stretch to think Marcy's boyfriend would have given me anything. Marcy and I shared none of the same friends. We weren't involved in any of the same clubs. None of our extracurricular activities overlapped. In short, we had nothing in common. A necklace. Savoring the fact that for once I didn't have to play defense, I gave her a gold medal smirk. Why, Marcy, I could have sworn giving another girl jewelry is a sign that your boyfriend is a cheat. She tilted her head back and laughed so convincingly I felt that same uneasiness settle back into my gut. I can't decide if it's sad that you're so completely in the dark, or funny. I folded my arms across my chest, aiming for a subtle show of annoyance and impatience. But the truth was, I was cold on the inside. A cold that didn't have to do with temperature. I was never going to escape this. I had a quick and terrible feeling that my run-in with Marcy was only the beginning, a subtle foreshadowing of what lay ahead. I don't have the necklace. You think you don't have it because you can't remember it. But you have it. It's probably sitting inside your jewelry box right now. You promised Patch you'd pass it along to me. She held out a scrap of paper for me to take. My number. Call me when you find the necklace. I took the paper, but I wasn't going to be bought that easily. Why didn't he just give you the necklace himself? We were both friends with Patch. At my look of deep skepticism, she added, There's a first time for everything, isn't there? I don't have the necklace, I repeated with finality. You have it, and I want it back. Could she be any more persistent? This weekend, when I have some free time, I'll look around for it. Sooner rather than later would be nice. My offer, take it or leave it. She flapped her arms. Why do you have a stick up your derriere? I kept my smile pleasant, my way of giving her the finger. I might not be able to remember the last 5 months, but the 16 years before that are crystal clear, including the 11 we've known each other. So this is about a grudge. Very mature. This is a matter of principle. I don't trust you because you've never given me a reason to. If you want me to believe you, you're going to have to show me why I should. You're such an idiot. Try to remember. If there was one good thing Patch did, it was bring us together. Did you know you came to my summer party? Ask around. You were there as my friend. Patch made me see a different side of you. I came to one of your parties? I was instantly skeptical. But why would she lie? She was right. I could ask around. It seemed foolish to make such a claim when the truth was so easy to prove. Apparently reading my thoughts, she said. Don't take my word for it. Really. Call around and see for yourself. Then she pushed the strap of her purse up onto her shoulder and sashayed out. I hung behind a few moments, gathering my cool. I had one equally bewildering and aggravating idea bouncing around in my head. Was there any possible way Marcy was telling the truth? Had her boyfriend, Patch, cracked years' worth of accumulated ice between us and brought us together? The idea was almost laughable. The phrase, "I'd have to see it to believe it," danced in my head. More than ever, I resented my faulty memory, if for no other reason than it placed me at a disadvantage with Marcy. And if Patch was both her summer fling and our mutual friend, where was he now? Leaving the restroom, I noticed Marcy and her mother were nowhere in sight. I assumed they'd asked to be reseated, or made a statement to Hank by leaving altogether. Either way, I wasn't complaining. As our table came into view, my stride slowed. Hank and my mom were holding hands across the table and gazing into each other's eyes in a deeply private way. He reached out to tuck a runaway strand of hair behind her ear. She blushed with pleasure. I backed away without realizing it. I was going to be sick. The biggest cliche, but painfully accurate. So much for dousing Hank with his wine. So much for morphing into a diva of epic proportions. Changing course, I ran for the front doors. I asked the hostess to relay the message to my mom that I'd called V for a ride, then hurried into the night. I swallowed several deep breaths. My blood pressure stabilized, and I stopped seeing double. A few stars glinted overhead, even though the western horizon still glowed from the recent sunset. It was just cool enough to make me wish I was wearing an extra layer, but in my rush to leave, I'd left my jean jacket hanging on the back of my chair. I wasn't going back for it now. I was more tempted to go back for my cell, but if I'd survived the past 3 months without one, I was pretty sure I could handle one more night. There was a 7-Eleven a handful of blocks away, and while I considered the possibility that it wasn't wise to be out alone at night, I also knew that I couldn't spend the rest of my life cowering in fear. If shark attack victims could get back in the ocean again, surely I could walk a few blocks by myself. I was in a very safe, well-lit part of town. If I wanted to force myself to break through my fear, I couldn't have selected a better location. 6 blocks later, I entered the 7-Eleven, the door chiming as I did. I was so caught up in my own thoughts, it took me a few beats to figure out that something was wrong. The store was eerily quiet. But I knew I wasn't alone. I'd seen heads through the plate glass window as I'd crossed the parking lot. 4 guys, from what I'd been able to tell. But they'd all vanished, and fast. Even the front counter was left unattended. I couldn't remember ever walking into a convenience store to find the front counter neglected. It was asking to be robbed, especially after dark. "Hello," I called out. I walked along the front of the store, glancing down the aisles, which stocked everything from Fig Newtons to Dramamine. "Is anyone here? I need to make change for the payphone." A muffled sound came from the hallway at the rear. It was unlit, presumably leading to the restrooms. I strained to hear the sound again. Given all the false alarms lately, I was afraid this was the beginning of another hallucination. Then I heard a second sound. The faint squeak of a door closing. I was pretty sure this sound was real, which meant someone could be hiding back there, just out of sight. Anxiety pinched my stomach, and I hustled outside. Rounding the building, I located the payphone and punched in 911. I heard only one ring before a hand reached over my shoulder, clicked the receiver, and ended the call. Chapter 8. I swung around. He had a good 6 inches and 50 pounds on me. The lights from the parking lot did a poor job of reaching back here, but I ran down a quick list of identifying features. Reddish blonde hair, gelled and spiked. Watery blue eyes. Studs in both ears. A shark tooth necklace. Light acne on the lower half of his face. A black tank top that showed off a muscly bicep inked with a fire-breathing dragon. need help? He asked with a twist of his lips. He offered me his cell phone, then braced an arm on the payphone, leaning into my private space. His smile was a little too sweet, a little too superior. Hate to see a pretty girl waste money on a call. When I didn't answer, he frowned slightly. Unless you were placing a free call. He scratched his cheek, a show of deep contemplation. But the only free call you can make from a payphone is to the police. Any hint of the angelic vanished from his tone. I swallowed. There was no one inside at the front counter. I thought something was wrong. And now I knew something was wrong. The only reason he'd care if I was calling the police was if it was in his best interest to keep them far, far away. A robbery, then? Let me make this simple for you, he said, slouching down and putting his face close to mine, as if I were 5 years old and needed slow, clear instruction. Get back in your car and keep driving. It dawned on me that he didn't realize I'd walked here. But the thought became a moot point when I heard scuffling coming from the alley just around the corner. There was a slew of curse words and a grunt of pain. I considered my options. I could take Sharktooth Necklace's advice and leave quickly, pretending I'd never been here. Or I could run to the next gas station down the road and call the police. But by then it might be too late. If they were robbing the store, Sharktooth and his friends weren't going to take their sweet time. My only other option was to stay put and make an either very brave or very stupid attempt to stop the robbery. "What's going on back there?" I asked innocently, signaling the rear of the building. "Look around," he replied, his voice soft and silky. "This place is empty. Nobody knows you're here. Nobody's ever going to remember you were here. Now be a good girl and get back in your car and drive away."
I...
He pressed his finger to my lips. "I'm not going to ask again." His voice was gentle, flirtatious even, but his eyes were icy pits. "I left my keys on the counter inside," I said, using the first excuse that came to mind, "when I first walked in." He took me by the arm and hauled me around to the front of the building. His stride was twice as long as mine, and I found myself half-jogging to keep up. All the while, I was mentally shaking myself, ordering my ingenuity to think up an excuse for when he figured out I was lying. I didn't know how he'd react, but I had a general idea, and it made my stomach flip upside down. The door chimed on our way in. He forced me over to the cash register and flicked aside a cardboard display of chapstick and a plastic bin of keychains for sale, clearly hunting for my lost keys. He moved to the next register and repeated his rushed hunt. Suddenly, he stopped. His eyes drifted idly over me. "Want to tell me where your keys really are?" I wondered if I could outrun him to the street. I wondered what the chances were that a car would drive by when I needed it most. And why, oh why, had I left Coopersmith without grabbing my jacket and cell phone? "What's your name?" he asked.
"Marcy," I lied.
"Let me tell you something, Marcy," he said, tucking a curl behind my ear. I tried to take a step back, but he pinched my ear in warning. So I stood there, enduring his touch as his finger trailed over the curve of my ear and along my jaw. He tipped my chin up, forcing me to meet his pale, almost translucent eyes. "Nobody lies to Gabe. When Gabe tells a girl to run along, she better run along. Otherwise, it makes Gabe angry. And that's a bad thing, because Gabe has a short temper. In fact, short is a generous way of putting it, you feel me?" I found it eerie that he referred to himself in the third person, but I wasn't about to make an issue of it. Instinct told me Gabe didn't like to be corrected, either, or questioned. "I'm sorry." I didn't dare turn away from him, afraid he might mistake such a movement for a sign of disrespect. "I want you to go now," he said in that deceptively velvet voice. I nodded, backing up. My elbow bumped the door, letting in a rush of cool air. As soon as I was outside, Gabe called through the glass door. 10? He was slouched against the front counter, a warped smile on his face. I didn't know why he'd said the word, but I held my expression in check as I continued to back away, faster now. 9, he called next. That's when I figured out he was counting backward. 8, he said, pushing up from the counter and taking a few lazy steps toward the door. He placed his palms on the glass, then drew an invisible heart with his finger. Seeing the stricken look on my face, he chuckled. 7. I turned and ran. I heard a car approaching on the main road, and I began shouting and flagging my arms. But I was still too far away, and the car zipped past, the drone of its engine vanishing around the bend. When I made it to the road, I glanced right, then left. On a hasty decision, I turned toward Coopersmith's. "Ready or not, here I come," I heard Gabe call out behind me. I pumped my arms harder, hearing the obnoxious slap of my ballet flats on the pavement. I wanted to throw a look over my shoulder and see how far back he was, but forced myself to concentrate on the bend in the road ahead. I tried to keep as much distance as possible between me and Gabe. A car would come soon. It had to. "Is that as fast as you can go?" He couldn't have been more than 20 feet behind. Worse, his voice didn't sound fatigued. I was struck by the horrible thought that he wasn't even trying. He was enjoying the cat and mouse, and while I grew more and more tired with every step, he grew more and more excited. "Keep going," he sing-songed, "but don't wear yourself out. It won't be any fun if you can't put up a fight when I catch you. I want to play." Ahead, I heard the deep rumble of an approaching engine. Headlights swung into view, and I moved into the middle of the road, frantically waving my arms. Gabe wouldn't hurt me with a witness looking on, would he? "Stop!" I yelled, continuing to hail what I could now see was a pickup truck rolling closer. The driver slowed beside me, cracking his window. He was middle-aged with a flannel shirt and smelled strongly of the fish stocks. "What's the matter?" he asked. His gaze shifted over my shoulder, where I felt Gabe's presence like a cold crackle in the air. "Just playing hide-and-seek," Gabe said, slinging his arm around my shoulders. I shrugged him off. "I've never seen this guy before," I told the man. "He threatened me at the 7-Eleven. I think he and his friends are trying to rob the store. When I walked in, the store was empty, and I heard a struggle in the back. We need to call the police." I paused, about to ask the man if he had a cell phone, when I watched with confusion as he turned to face forward, ignoring me. He cranked his window all the way up, locking himself inside the cab of the truck. "You have to help," I said, rapping his window. But his forward fixed stare didn't waver. A little chill danced over my skin. The man wasn't going to help. He was going to leave me out here with Gabe. Gabe mimicked me, knocking obnoxiously on the man's window. "Help me," he cried in a shrill voice. "Gabe and his friends are robbing the 7-Eleven. Oh, mister, you have to help me stop them." When he finished, he flung his head back, choking on his own laughter. Almost robotically, the man in the truck looked over at us. His eyes were slightly crossed and unblinking. "What's the matter with you?" I said, rattling the truck's door handle. I smacked the window again. "Call the police!" The man stepped on the gas. The truck accelerated slowly, and I jogged beside it, still clinging to the hope that I could open the door. He fed the truck more gas, and I tripped over my feet to keep up. Suddenly, he took off like a shot, and I was flung off into the road. I whirled to Gabe. "What did you do to him?" "This." I flinched, hearing the word echo inside my head like a phantom presence. Gabe's eyes blackened into hollows. His hair started visibly growing, first on top of his head and then everywhere. It tufted out from his arms down to the tips of his fingers until he was covered in fur. Matted, reeking, brown fur. He lumbered toward me on his hind legs, gaining height until he towered over me. He swiped his arm and I saw a flash of claws. Then he crashed down on all fours, put his wet black nose in my face and roared, an angry, reverberating sound. He had transformed into a grizzly bear. In my terror, I tripped backward and went down. I scuttled backward, blindly sweeping the roadside for a rock. Catching one in my hand, I hurled it at the bear. It hit him in the shoulder and bounced aside. I grabbed another rock, aiming for his head. The rock flew into his snout, and he snapped his head to the side, saliva trailing from his mouth. He roared again, then came at me faster than I could scramble backward. Using his paw, he flattened me against the pavement. He was pushing too hard. My ribs creaked in pain. "Stop!" I tried to shove his paw off, but he was much too strong. I didn't know if he could hear me, or understand. I didn't know if any part of Gabe was left inside the bear. Never before in my life had I witnessed anything so inexplicably horrifying. The wind picked up, tangling my hair across my face. Through it, I watched the wind carry off the bear's fur. Little tufts of it drifted up into the night. When I looked again, it was Gabe leaning over me. His sadistic grin implied, "You are my puppet, and don't you forget it." I wasn't sure which terrified me more, Gabe or the bear. "Up you go," he said, hoisting me to my feet. He propelled me back along the road until the lights of the 7-Eleven came into view. My mind staggered. Had he hypnotized me? Made me believe he'd turned himself into a bear? Was there any other explanation? I knew I had to get out of here and call for help, but I hadn't come up with the how yet. We rounded the building to the alley where the others were congregated. Two were dressed in street clothes, similar to Gabe's. The third was wearing a lime green polo with 7-Eleven and the name BJ embroidered on the pocket. BJ was on his knees, clutching his ribs, moaning inconsolably. His eyes were squeezed shut and saliva trickled from the corner of his mouth. One of Gabe's friends, he wore an oversized gray hoodie, stood over BJ with a tire iron, raised and ready to swing, presumably again. My mouth went dry, and my legs seemed to be made of straw. I couldn't unglue my eyes from the dark red stain seeping through the midsection of BJ's shirt. "You're hurting him," I said, aghast. Gabe held his hand out for the tire iron, and it was readily given to him. "You mean this?" Gabe asked with mock sincerity. He swung the tire iron down square against BJ's back, and I heard a grotesque crunch. BJ screamed, collapsed onto his side, and writhed in pain. Gabe stretched the tire iron across the back of his shoulders, hanging his arms over it like it was a baseball bat. "Home run!" he hollered. The other two laughed. I was dizzy with the need to be sick. "Just take the money," I said, my voice rising toward a shout. Clearly this was a robbery, but they were taking it five steps too far. "You're going to kill him if you keep hitting him." A snicker moved through the group as if they knew something I did not. "Kill him? Unlikely," Gabe said. "He's already bleeding heavily." Gabe raised an uncaring shoulder, and that's when I knew he wasn't just cruel, but insane. "He'll heal. Not if he doesn't get to a hospital soon." Gabe used his shoe to nudge BJ, who had rolled over and planted his forehead on the cement apron spreading out from the back entrance. His whole body trembled, and I thought it looked like he was going into shock. "Did you hear her?" Gabe yelled down at BJ. "You need to get to a hospital. I'll drive you there myself and dump you in front of the ER. But first, you got to say it. Swear the oath." With great effort, BJ lifted his head to fix a withering stare on Gabe. He opened his mouth, and I thought he was going to say whatever it was they all wanted him to, but instead he spat, hitting Gabe in the leg. "You can't kill me," he sneered, but his teeth chattered and his eyes rolled back to whites, clearly showing he was on the brink of fainting. "The Black Hand told me." "Wrong answer," Gabe said, tossing the tire iron up and catching it like a baton. When the trick ended, he swooped the tire iron down in a violent arc. The metal smashed over BJ's spine, causing him to jerk rod straight and cry out in a hair-raising yowl. I drew both hands over my mouth, transfixed by horror. Horror from both the gruesome picture in front of me and from a word screaming inside my head. It was as though the word had snapped free from deep in my subconscious and smacked me head-on. Nephilim. That's what BJ is, I thought, even though the word meant nothing to me. And they're trying to force him to swear an oath of fealty. It was a frightening revelation, because I didn't know what any of it meant. Where was I getting this from? How could I know anything about what was happening when I'd never seen anything like it before? I was torn from any further thought on the matter when a white SUV swung into the alley ahead, the beam of its headlights causing all of us to freeze. Gabe discreetly lowered the tire iron, hiding it behind his leg. I prayed that whoever was behind the wheel would reverse out of the alley and call the police. If the driver came much closer, well, I'd already seen what Gabe could do to convince people not to help. I began drafting ideas in my mind of how to drag BJ from the scene while Gabe and the others were distracted, when one of the guys, the one in the gray hoodie, asked Gabe, "Do you think they're Nephilim?" Nephilim, that word, again, spoken out loud this time. Instead of comforting me, the word only ratcheted up my terror another few notches. I knew the word, and now it seemed Gabe and his friends did too. How could we possibly have it in common? How could we have anything in common? Gabe shook his head. "They'd bring more than one car. The Black Hand wouldn't go up against us with less than 20 of his guys." "Police, then. Could be an unmarked car. I can go convince them they've made a wrong turn." The way he said it made me wonder if Gabe wasn't the only one capable of his powerful brand of hypnotism. Maybe his two friends were as well. The guy in the gray hoodie started forward, when Gabe put his arm out, catching him in the chest. "Wait." The SUV rumbled closer, gravel popping under its wheels. My legs hummed with nervous adrenaline. If a fight broke out, Gabe and the others might get so wrapped up in it I could grab BJ under his armpits and haul him out of the alley. A slim chance, but a chance nonetheless. Suddenly Gabe boomed with laughter. He slapped his friends on the back, his teeth gleaming. "Well, well, boys, look who came to the party after all." Chapter 9. The white SUV rolled to a stop and the engine cut off. The driver's side door opened, and through the grainy darkness, someone stepped out. Male, tall, loose-fit jeans and a white and navy baseball tee pushed up to his elbows. His face was concealed under the brim of a ball cap, but I saw the strong line of his jaw and the shape of his mouth, and the picture jolted me like a current of electricity. The flash of black bursting at the back of my mind was so intense, the color completely stained my vision for several seconds. "Decided to join us, after all," Gabe called to him. The newcomer didn't answer. "This one's offering resistance," Gabe continued, driving the toe of his shoe into BJ, who was still coiled in a ball on the ground. "Doesn't want to swear fealty. Thinks he's too good for me. And this coming from a crossbreed." Laughter circled through Gabe and his two friends, but if the driver of the SUV got the joke, he didn't show it. Sliding his hands into his pockets, he studied us in silence. I thought his gaze lingered a little long on me, but I was strung so tight I could have seen something that wasn't really there. "Why is she here?" he asked quietly, lifting his chin at me. "Wrong place, wrong time," Gabe said. "Now she's a witness. I told her to keep driving." Was it just me, or did Gabe sound defensive? It was the first time all night anyone, however subtly, had questioned his authority, and I could practically feel the air around him sizzle with a negative charge. "And?" "She wouldn't leave. She's going to remember everything." Gabe swung the tire iron agilely in his hand, round and round. "I can convince her not to talk." The driver's eyes shifted to BJ's balled-up form. "Just like you convinced this one to talk?" Gabe frowned. His grip on the tire iron tightened. "Got a better idea." "Yeah, let her go." Gabe thumbed his nose and gave a snort of laughter. "Let her go," he repeated. "What'll stop her from running straight to the police? Huh, Jev? Thought that one through?" "You're not afraid of the police," Jev said calmly, but I thought I detected a hint of challenge. His second indirect threat to Gabe's power. Taking a risk, I decided to insert myself into their argument. "If you let me go, I promise I won't talk. Just let me take him with me." I motioned at BJ's crumpled figure, and I said the words like they came from the very bottom of my soul. But I entertained the scary realization that I would have to talk. I couldn't let this kind of violence go unpunished. If Gabe was free, nothing was stopping him from torturing and terrorizing another victim. I shielded those thoughts from my eyes, suddenly worried that Gabe would see through me. "You heard her," Jev said. Gabe's jaw clenched. "No, he's mine. I've been waiting months for him to turn 16. I'm not walking away now." "There'll be others," Jev said, looking uncannily relaxed as he laced his fingers on top of his head. He shrugged. "Walk away." "Yeah, and be like you? You don't have a Nafil vassal. It's going to be a long, lonely Cheshvan, pal." "Cheshvan is still weeks away. You've got time. You'll find someone else. Let the Nafil and the girl go." Gabe stepped up to Jev. Jev was taller and smarter and knew how to keep his cool. I'd gathered that in all of 3 seconds. But Gabe had the advantage of bulk. Where Jev was long and lean like a cheetah, Gabe was built like a bull. "You turned us down earlier. Said you had other business tonight. Far as I'm concerned, this isn't your call. I'm sick of you strolling in at the last minute and calling the shots. I'm not leaving until the Nafil swears his oath of fealty." There was that phrase again, oath of fealty. Vaguely familiar, and yet distant. If on some deeper level I knew what it meant, the memory wasn't resurfacing. Either way, I knew it would have terrible consequences for BJ. "This is my night," Gabe added, punctuating the fact by spitting at his feet. "I'm ending it on my terms." "Wait a minute. the guy in the gray hoodie interrupted, sounding stupefied. His eyes swiveled in both directions down the alley. Gabe, you're Nafeel. He's gone. We all turned toward the spot where BJ had lain inert only moments ago. An oily stain on the gravel was the only sign he'd been there. He couldn't have gone far, Gabe snapped. Dominic, go that way, he ordered the guy in the gray hoodie, pointing down the alley. Jeremiah, check the store. The other guy, the one in a white graphic t-shirt, took off jogging around the corner. What about her? Jev asked Gabe, nodding at me. Why don't you make yourself useful and go bring me back my Nafeel? Gabe shot back. Jev raised his hands level with his shoulders. Have it your way. I felt my stomach tumble to my knees as I realized that this was it. Jev was leaving. He was friends with, or at least an acquaintance of Gabe, and that alone was enough to make me nervous of him. But at the same time, he was my only shot at getting out of here. Up until this point, he'd appeared to take my side. If he left, I was on my own. Gabe had made it clear he was the alpha male, and I wasn't going to pretend I thought his remaining two friends would stand up to him. You're going to walk away, just like that? I yelled after Jev. But Gabe rammed his shoe into the back of my leg, forcing me to collapse to my knees, and before I could say more, my breath was knocked out of me. It'll be easier if you don't watch, Gabe told me. One solid hit, and it'll be the last thing you feel. I lunged forward to escape, but Gabe grabbed a fistful of my hair, jerking me back. You can't do this, I screamed. You can't just kill me. Hold still, he growled. Don't let him do this, Jev, I yelled, unable to see Jev, but certain he could still hear me since I hadn't heard the SUV start up yet. I was rolling in the gravel, trying to turn around so I could see the tire iron and try to dodge it. I wrapped my fist around a scoop of rocks, twisted violently just long enough to spot Gabe, and flung them. His big hand came down, grinding my forehead into the ground. My nose was bent at a painful angle, rocks biting into my chin and cheeks. There was a sickening crunch, and Gabe collapsed on top of me. Through a haze of panic, I wondered if he was trying to smother me. Killing me quickly wasn't enough, was it? Had to draw out the pain as long as possible. Gasping for breath, I clawed my way out from under him. I scrambled to my feet and flipped around. I braced myself in a defensive position, expecting to find Gabe prepping to take a second shot at me. My gaze dropped. He was face down on the ground, the tire iron jutting out of his back. He'd been stabbed with it. Jev wiped his sleeve across his face, which glistened with sweat. At his feet, Gabe twitched and shuddered, swearing violently and incoherently. I couldn't believe he was still alive. The tire iron had to be straight through his spine. You stabbed him, I blurted, horror-struck. And he's not going to be happy about it, so I'd suggest you get out of here, Jev said, twisting the tire iron deeper. He glanced over at me and did an eyebrow raise. Sooner rather than later. I backed away. What about you? He watched me for an absurdly long moment, considering the circumstances. A brief expression of regret flicked across his features. Once again, I felt a powerful tug to my memory that threatened to mend the bridge holding everything out of reach. I opened my mouth, but the conduit between my mind and my words had been destroyed. I was at a loss as to how to connect the two. I had something to say to him, but I couldn't nail down what. You can sit tight, but I'm guessing BJ already put a call into the cops, Jev said, screwing the tire iron deeper, causing Gabe's body to spring taut at one moment and fall limp the next. As if on cue, the distant wail of sirens shrilled across the night. Jev grabbed Gabe under his arms, dragging him into the weeds on the far side of the alley. On the back roads, at the right speed, you can put a couple miles between you and this place in no time.
I don't have a car.
His eyes sliced into mine. I walked here, I explained. I'm on foot.
Angel, he said in a way that sounded like he sincerely hoped I was joking.
A few moments together hardly qualified us for pet names, but nonetheless my heartbeat went a little erratic at the endearment. Angel. How could he possibly know that name had haunted me for days now? How could I possibly explain the eerie flashes of black that intensified the closer he came? Most unnerving of all, if I connected the dots.
Patch,
a voice whispered from my subconscious. A quiet syllable that dashed itself against a cage deep within. The last time you felt this way was when Marcy mentioned Patch. The single syllable of his name opened me up to a swarm of black, maddening, consuming black that flooded from every direction.
I concentrated through it, eyes intent on Jev, trying to make sense of a feeling I couldn't put words to. He knew something I didn't. Maybe about the mysterious patch, maybe about me. Definitely about me. His presence cut me with emotions too deep to be a coincidence. But how were Patch, Marcy, Jev, and I connected? "Do I know you?" I asked him, unable to come up with any other explanation. He gazed at me, unflinching. "No car," he confirmed, ignoring my question. "No car," I repeated, my voice considerably thinner. He arched his neck back as though to ask the moon, "Why me?" Then he jerked his thumb at the white SUV he'd pulled up in. "Get in." I shut my eyes, trying to think. "Wait, we have to stay and testify. If we run, we might as well be confessing our guilt. I'll tell the police you killed Gabe to save my life." Further inspiration struck me. "We'll find BJ and get him to testify, too." Jev opened the driver's side door of the SUV.
"All of the above would be true if the police could be relied on."
"What are you talking about? They're the police. It's their job to catch criminals. We're not in the wrong here. Gabe would have killed me if you hadn't stepped in."
"That part I don't doubt."
"Then what?"
"This isn't the kind of case local law enforcement is set up to handle."
"I'm pretty sure murder falls under the jurisdiction of the law," I argued.
"Two things," he said patiently. "First, I didn't kill Gabe. I stunned him. Second, believe me when I say Jeremiah and Dominic will not go into custody willingly and without a lot of bloodshed."
I opened my mouth to argue when, from the corner of my eye, I saw Gabe twitch again. Miraculously, he wasn't dead. I remembered the way he'd manipulated my sight with what I could only guess was a powerful form of hypnotism or a magician's sleight of hand. Was he using another trick to somehow evade death? I had the eerie sensation that something bigger than I understood was going on, but what exactly?
"Tell me what you're thinking," Jev said quietly.
I hesitated, but there wasn't time for it. If Jev knew Gabe as well as I suspected, he had to know about his abilities. "I saw Gabe do a trick, a magic trick." When Jeb's grim expression confirmed that he wasn't surprised, I added, "He made me see something that wasn't real. He turned himself into a bear."
"That's the tip of the iceberg when it comes to what he's capable of."
I swallowed against the sticky film lining my mouth. "How did he do it? Is he a magician?"
"Something like that."
"He used magic?" I'd never given 2 moments thought that such convincing magic might actually exist. Until now.
"Close enough. Listen, time's running a little thin."
My gaze traveled to the weeds partially concealing Gabe's body. Magicians could create illusions, but they could not defy death. There was no logical way he could have survived. The sirens blared closer, and Jev ushered me toward the SUV.
"Time's up."
I didn't move. I couldn't. I had a moral responsibility to stay.
Jev said, "If you hang around to talk to the police, you'll be dead before the week is over, and so will every cop involved. Gabe will stop the investigation before it starts."
I took another 2 seconds to think it through. I didn't have to trust Jev, but in the end, for reasons too complicated to untangle on the spot, I did. I strapped myself in beside him, my heart thundering behind my ribcage. He put what I could now see was a Tahoe in gear. With one arm braced behind my seat, he craned his neck to see out the back window. Jev reversed down the alley, backed onto the street, then gunned forward toward the intersection ahead. There was a stop sign on the corner, but the Tahoe wasn't slowing. I was just wondering if Jev would at least yield for the stop sign as I clutched the granny handle above my door with both hands and hoped he would, when a dark silhouette staggered into our lane. The tire iron projecting out of Gabe's back was wrenched at a gruesome angle, and in the hazy light it resembled a broken appendage, a battered wing. Jev stepped on the gas and threw the SUV into higher gear. It pitched forward, increasing in speed. Gabe was too far away to read his expression, but he showed no sign of moving. He crouched, tucking his legs beneath him, his hands up in front of him as though he thought he could block us. I gripped the seatbelt strap. "You're going to hit him!"
"He'll move."
My foot stomped an imaginary brake pedal. The distance between Gabe and the Tahoe rapidly narrowed. "Jev, stop! Right now!"
"This won't kill him either."
He forced the Tahoe into another burst of speed, and then it all happened too quickly. Gabe lunged, hurtling through the air toward us. He struck the windshield, the glass cracking into a lattice-like web. An instant later, he flew out of sight. A scream filled the car, and I realized it was mine.
"He's on top of the car," Jev said.
He floored it over the curb, plowing through a sidewalk bench and driving under a low-hanging tree. Jerking the steering wheel a hard left, he steered back onto the street. Did he fall off? Where is he? Is he still up there? I pressed my face to my window, trying to see above me. Hang on.
To what? I shouted, grasping for the granny handle again.
I never felt the brake, but Jev must have stepped on it because the Tahoe spun a full rotation before squealing to a stop. My shoulder was slammed up against the doorframe. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a dark mass fly through the air and land with cat-like grace on the ground. Gabe stayed there a moment, crouching, his back to us. Jev threw the Tahoe into first gear. Gabe looked back over his shoulder. His hair clung to the sides of his face, a sheen of sweat holding it in place. His eyes locked with mine. His mouth tipped up diabolically. He said something just as the Tahoe lunged into motion, and even though I couldn't decipher a single word from the movement of his lips, the message was clear. This isn't over. I pressed back in my seat, swallowing gulps of air as Jev peeled away in a manner I was sure left tire treads tattooed on the street. Chapter 10. Jev drove only 5 blocks. It dawned on me a little late that I should have asked him to take me to Coopersmith's, but he'd opted for the obscurity of the back roads. He steered the Tahoe to the shoulder of a peaceful country road lined by acres of trees and cornfields.
"Can you find your way home from here?"
he asked. "You're just going to dump me here?" But the real question framed in my mind was this. Why had Jev, presumably one of them, alienated himself to save me?
"If you're worried about Gabe, trust me. He's got more on his mind right now than tracking you down. He won't be doing much of anything until he gets the tire iron out. I'm surprised he had the strength to chase us as far as he did. Even after he gets it out, he'll have what I can only describe as a killer hangover. He's not going to be in the mood to do much other than sleep for the next several hours. If you're waiting for the perfect moment to make a break for it, you aren't going to get a better one."
When I didn't budge, he jerked his thumb back the way we'd come.
"I need to make sure Dominic and Jeremiah clear out."
I knew he wanted me to take a hint, but I wasn't convinced. Why are you really protecting them? Maybe Jev was right, and Dominic and Jeremiah would fight the police. Maybe it would end in a bloodbath. But wasn't the risk better than letting them walk free? Jev's eyes were fixed on the darkness beyond the windshield.
"Because I'm one of them."
I immediately shook my head. "You're not like them. They would have killed me. You came back for me. You stopped Gabe." Instead of answering, he angled out of the Tahoe and came around to my side. He yanked my door open and pointed into the night.
"Head that way to town. If your cell phone doesn't work, keep walking until the trees clear. Sooner or later, you'll get reception."
"I don't have my cell."
He paused only a beat. "Then when you get to Whitetail Lodge, ask the front desk for their phone. You can call home from there."
I slid out. "Thanks for saving me from Gabe, and thanks for the ride," I said civilly. "But for future reference, I don't appreciate being lied to. I know there's a lot you aren't telling me. Maybe you think I don't deserve to know. Maybe you think you hardly know me and I'm not worth the trouble. But given what I just went through, I think I've earned the right to the truth." To my surprise, he nodded. Not eagerly. A reluctant inclination of his head that said, "Fair enough."
"I'm protecting them because I have to. If the police see them in action, it will blow our cover. This town isn't ready for Dominic, Jeremiah, or any of us."
He watched me, his razor-sharp eyes softening to a velvety black. There was something so consuming about the way his eyes took me in. I almost felt his gaze like a real touch.
"And I'm not ready to leave town yet," he murmured, his eyes still holding mine.
He stepped closer, and I felt my breath come a little faster. His skin was darker than mine, more rugged. He wasn't beautiful enough to be handsome. He was all hard, prominent angles. And he was telling me that he was different. Not because he was unlike any other guy I'd ever known, but because he was something else entirely. I clung to the one strange new word that had stayed with me all night. "Are you Nephilim?" Almost as if he'd been shocked, he jerked back. The whole moment snapped apart.
"Go home and get on with your life," he said. "Do that and you'll be safe."
With his blunt brush off, I felt tears spring to my eyes. He saw them and shook his head in apology.
"Look, Nora..."
He tried again, resting his hands on my shoulders. I stiffened in his embrace. "How do you know my name?" The moon broke briefly through the clouds, allowing me a glimpse of his eyes. The soft velvet was gone, replaced by a hard and hooded black. His were the kind of eyes that held secrets, the kind that lied without flinching, the kind that once you looked into them, it was hard to break away. We were both damp from the exertion of our earlier escape and what I assumed was the lingering scent of his shower gel hung between us. It held the slightest trace of mint and black pepper, and the memory of it rushed through me so fast I was left dizzy. I had no way to trace it, but I knew the scent. Even more unsettling, I knew Jev. Somehow, whether it was in a trivial way or something much larger and therefore much more disconcerting, Jev had been a part of my life. There was no other way to explain the searing flashbacks that came from being near him. It crossed my mind that maybe he was my kidnapper, but the idea didn't have a lot of conviction behind it. I didn't believe it, maybe because I didn't want to. "We knew each other, didn't we?" I said, my extremities tingling. "Tonight isn't the first time we've met." When Jev stayed quiet, I was pretty sure I had my answer. "Do you know about my amnesia? Do you know I can't remember the last 5 months? Is that why you thought you could get away with pretending not to know me?" "Yes," he said wearily. My heart beat faster. "Why?" "I didn't want to pin a target on your back. If Gabe thought we had a connection, he could use you to hurt me." Fine, he'd answered that question, but I didn't want to talk about Gabe. How did we know each other? And after we left Gabe behind, why did you still pretend not to know me? What are you keeping from me? I waited restlessly. Are you going to fill in the gaps?
No.
No? He merely looked at me. Then you're a selfish jerk. The accusation flew out before I could stop it, but I wasn't going to take it back. He may have saved my life, but if he knew something about those missing 5 months and refused to tell me, anything he'd done to redeem himself was lost in my eyes.
If I had anything good to tell you, trust me, I'd start talking.
I can handle bad news, I said curtly. He shook his head and sidestepped me, heading back to the driver's side. I grabbed his arm. His eyes dropped to my hand, but he didn't pull free. Tell me what you know, I said. What happened to me? Who did this to me? Why can't I remember those 5 months? What was so bad that I'm choosing to forget? His face was a mask, all emotion compartmentalized away. The only sign that he had heard me was a muscle flexing in his jaw.
I'm going to give you some advice, and for once, I want you to take it. Go back to your life and move on. Start over if you have to. Do whatever it takes to leave this all behind. This will end badly if you keep looking back.
This? I don't even know what this is. I can't move on. I want to know what happened to me. Do you know who kidnapped me? Do you know where they took me and why?
Does it matter?
How dare you? I said, not bothering to swallow away the choked-up quality of my voice. How dare you stand here and make light of what I've been through?
If you find out who took you, is it going to help? Will it be the closure you need to pick yourself up and start living again?
No, he answered for me. Yes, it will. What Jeb didn't understand was that anything was better than nothing. Half full was better than empty. Ignorance was the lowest form of humiliation and suffering. He let go of a troubled sigh, raking his fingers through his hair.
We knew each other, he relented. We met 5 months ago, and I was bad news from the moment you laid eyes on me. I used you and hurt you. Fortunately, you had the good sense to kick me out of your life before I could come back for round two. The last time we spoke, you swore that if you ever saw me again, you'd do your best to kill me. Maybe you meant it, maybe not. Either way, there was a lot of strong emotion behind it. Is that what you were looking for?
He finished. I blinked. I couldn't imagine myself making such a malicious threat. The closest I'd ever come to hating someone was Marcy Miller, and even then I'd never fantasized about her death. I was human, but I wasn't heartless. Why would I say that? What did you do that was so horrible?
I tried to kill you.
I met his eyes sharply. The line of his mouth, grim but steady, told me he wasn't in the slightest way joking.
You wanted the truth, he said. Deal with it, Angel.
Deal with it? It doesn't make any sense. Why did you want to kill me?
For fun, because I was bored. Does it matter? I tried to kill you.
No, something wasn't right. If you wanted to kill me back then, why did you help me tonight?
You're missing the point. I could have ended your life. Do yourself a favor and run as far and as fast from me as you can.
He turned away with a dismissive gesture, signaling for me to walk in the opposite direction. This was the last we'd see of each other. You're a liar. He turned around, his black eyes snapping.
I'm also a thief, a gambler, a cheat, and a murderer. But this happens to be one of the rare times when I'm telling the truth. Go home. Consider yourself lucky. You've got a chance to start fresh. Not everyone can say the same.
I'd wanted the truth, but I was more confused than ever. How had I, a straight-laced, straight-A student, ever crossed paths with him? What could we possibly have had in common? He was abominable, and the most alluring, tortured soul I'd ever met. Even now, I could feel a war brewing inside me. He was nothing like me, quick and caustic and dangerous, maybe even a little scary. But from the moment he'd stepped out of the Tahoe tonight, my heart hadn't been able to find a steady rhythm. In his presence, every last nerve ending in my body felt wired with electricity.
"One last thing," he said. "Stop looking for me."
"I'm not looking for you," I scoffed. He touched his index finger to my forehead, my skin absurdly warming under his touch. It didn't escape me that he couldn't seem to stop finding reasons to touch me, nor did I miss that I didn't want him to stop.
"Under all the layers, a part of you remembers. It's that part that came looking for me tonight. It's that part that's going to get you killed if you're not careful."
We stood face to face, both of us breathing hard. The sirens were so close now. "What am I supposed to tell the police?" I said.
"You're not going to talk to the police."
"Oh, really? Funny, because I plan on telling them exactly how you rammed that tire iron into Gabe's back, unless you answer my questions." He gave an ironic snort.
"Blackmail? You've changed, Angel."
Another strategic stab to my blind side, making me feel even more unsure and self-conscious. I would have squeezed my memory, trying to place him one last time, but I knew it was wrung dry. Since I couldn't rely on my memory, I'd just have to cast my nets elsewhere and hope for the best. I said, "If you know me as well as you claim to, you know I'm not going to stop looking for whoever it was who kidnapped me until I either find them or hit rock bottom."
"And let me tell you where rock bottom will be," he returned with a gravelly edge. "Your grave. A shallow, backwoods grave where no one will find you. No one will come to your gravesite and mourn for you. As far as humanity is concerned, you'll vanish off the grid. It will wear on your mom. That constant, menacing sense of the unknown, it will peck away at her, driving her closer to the edge until it shoves her over. And instead of being buried in some green-lawned cemetery beside you, where loved ones can visit you until the end of time, she'll be alone. And so will you. For eternity."
I stood taller, determined to show him I wasn't going to be scared off that easily, but I felt a queasy little flutter of premonition in my belly. "Tell me, or I'll rat you out to the cops. That's a promise. I want to know where I've been, and I want to know who took me." He dragged a hand down his mouth, laughing to himself. It was a tense, tired sound. "Who kidnapped me?" I snapped, running out of patience. I wasn't moving from this spot until he confessed what he knew. I suddenly resented him for saving my life earlier. I wanted to view him with nothing short of hot contempt and hatred. I'd point him out to the police without a moment's hesitation if he refused to tell me what he knew. He raised those impenetrable eyes to mine, his mouth crooking down on one side. Not a frown, something infinitely more bewildering and frightening.
"You're not supposed to be in this anymore. Even I can't keep you safe."
Then he walked away, having said all he was going to, but I couldn't accept it. This was my one chance to make sense of the part of my life that was missing. I stomped after him and grabbed the back of his shirt so hard it tore. I didn't care. I had bigger things to worry about. I said, "What am I not supposed to be involved in anymore?" Only the words didn't come out right. They were sucked away from me at the exact same time that a hook seemed to latch behind my stomach and yank me inside out. I felt myself being hurled through the air and every muscle in my body tensed, bracing for the unknown. The last thing I remembered was the roar of air past my ears and the world crashing to black. Chapter 11. When I opened my eyes, I wasn't on the street anymore. The Tahoe, the cornfields, the starry night, it was all gone. I stood inside a concrete building that smelled of sawdust and something slightly metallic, like rust. I was shivering, but not from cold. I'd grabbed Jev's shirt. I'd heard fabric ripping. I might have touched his back. And now, I was in what appeared to be a vacant warehouse. Ahead, I saw two figures, Jev and Hank Miller. Relieved that I wasn't in this place alone, I strode toward them, hoping they could tell me where I was and how I'd gotten here. "Jev!" I called out. Neither one so much as looked in my direction, but surely they'd heard me. In this vast space, voices carried. I was about to open my mouth a second time when I came to a startled halt. Behind them, the evenly spaced bars of a cage peeked out from under a canvas. In a great wave, it all came back to me. The cage, the girl with icy black hair, the high school bathroom. When I'd blacked out momentarily, my palms tingled with sweat, it could mean only one thing. I was hallucinating. Again.
"You brought me here to show me this?" Jev told Hank with quiet disgust. "Do you understand the risk I take every time we meet? Don't call me here to chat. Don't call me here for a shoulder to cry on. Don't ever call me here to show off your latest conquest."
"Patience, boy. I showed you the Archangel because I need your help.
Obviously, we both have questions."
He looked meaningfully at the cage.
"Well, she has answers."
"My curiosity for that life died a long time ago."
"Whether you want it or not, this life is still yours. I've tried everything to persuade her to talk, but she's cagey, pardon the pun."
He smiled mildly.
"Get her to tell me what I need to know, and I'll turn her over to you. I doubt I need to remind you the trouble the Archangels have caused for you. If there were a way to seek revenge, well, surely I don't need to say more."
"How have you managed to keep her caged?" Jev asked coolly.
Hank's mouth twisted with amusement.
"Sawed off her wings.
Just because I can't see them doesn't mean I don't have a pretty good idea where they are. You put the idea in my head. Before you, I never would have imagined an Nephil could unwing an angel."
Something dark stirred in Jev's eyes.
"An ordinary saw couldn't cut through her wings."
"I didn't use an ordinary saw."
"Whatever you're messed up in, Hank, I'd advise you to get out. Fast."
"If you knew what I was messed up in, you'd beg me to let you in on it. The Archangel's empire won't last forever. There are powers out there that surpass even theirs. Powers waiting to be harnessed if you know where to look," he said cryptically.
With a disgusted gesture, Jev turned to go.
"Our agreement, boy," Hank called after him.
"This wasn't part of it."
"Perhaps we can come to a new arrangement, then. Rumor has it you haven't forced Nephil to swear fealty. Cheshvan is only weeks away."
He let the sentence hang.
Jev stopped.
"You'd offer me one of your own men?"
"For the greater good, yes."
Hank spread his hands, chuckling softly.
"You'd have your pick. Am I making this offer too good to refuse yet?"
"I wonder what your men would think if they knew you were selling them off to the highest bidder."
"Swallow your pride. Pushing my buttons won't settle the score. Let me tell you why I've made it as far as I have in this life. I don't take things personally. You shouldn't either. Don't let this be about you and me and past differences. We both have something to gain. Help me, and I'll help you. It's as simple as that."
He paused, giving Jev time to think.
"Last time you walked away from an offer of mine, it ended disastrously,"
Hank added with a certain curl of his lips.
"I'm done making deals with you," Jev answered in measured tones. "But I'll give you some advice. Let her go. The Archangels are going to notice she's missing. Kidnapping might be your strong suit, but this time you're pushing your luck. We both know how this is going to end. The Archangels don't lose."
But they do," Hank corrected. "They lost when your kind fell. They lost again when you created the Nephilim race. They can lose again, and they will. All the more reason you should act now. We have one of their own, giving us the upper hand. Together, you and I can turn the tables. Together, boy. But we must act now."
I sat against the wall and hugged my knees to my chest. I let my head tip back until it rested on concrete. Deep breaths.